The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spergotta for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Country. We discussed Oprah Winfrey's best-selling book, What Happened to You? Conversations on Trauma, Resilience, and Healing. Now we were getting ready to film our book club discussion, and my heart was pounding as we waited for our special guest, Oprah, to appear on Zoom. When she graciously accepted my invitation, what she didn't know was that she had been a guiding force in my life, but not always a welcome one. In 2011, while browsing YouTube, a clip of Oprah's life classes popped up, and I pushed play. Her powerful words blazed through my ears. If you in any way are keeping a secret or in any way pretending to be something you're not, you will never ever become all you were meant to be. My heart felt a heavy sting as something inside me screamed that she could be right. I felt as though she was calling me out, as if she knew my secret. My fingers trembled and I felt she had no right to voice such dangerous words. Panicked and angry, I slammed my computer shut. For years, I continued on with a facade of being the perfect CEO's wife and mother of three children, attending charity events, and living in my beautiful home. Behind closed doors, my life held darker storylines. Underneath it all, I had been fighting a losing battle with bipolar disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and panic anxiety disorder. I hid this truth rather than risk unleashing the inevitable stigma and judgment I assumed were sure to follow. That hell drove me to violate one of my most sacred beliefs, that my life belonged to God. Unable to stop the falling dominoes, I attempted suicide by swallowing hundreds of antipsychotic pills in 2015. That was the moment suicide went from being a whisper to a scream, and my heart wished to be deaf. Thankfully, my husband found me in time, and the ER doctors were able to save my life. When I woke up in the intensive care unit, it took nearly a week for me to walk and talk again. A few days after being released from the hospital, I stood in my dining room looking out the window at some of my neighbors laughing with each other. I wish I could say that I became courageous and spoke my truth all of a sudden, but that's not how my secret got out. My neighbors now knew I had mental health challenges because they'd seen the ambulance lights blaring in my driveway as the medics rushed my unconscious body out of my house on a stretcher. Yet only one neighbor had stopped by since my return to see if I was actually okay. I took a deep breath and carefully walked outside. As I approached my neighbors, their conversation abruptly ended. We stood in heart-wrenching silence. Their discomfort made me recall what a psychiatrist told my husband, who was the CEO of the hospital where I had recently been discharged. Next time, take her to a hospital where no one knows you. After a few awkward words, I wrapped my bruised heart tightly in my coat and slowly walked back to my home feeling very small. I knew the truth needed to be told, but I didn't know how. The sad reality was that at 44 years old, I did not know how to use my own voice. 4 years later, I found myself watching the Golden Globe Awards. Oprah accepted the Cecil B. DeMille Award and stated during her speech, "Speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. And I'm especially proud and inspired by all the women who felt strong enough and empowered enough to speak up and share their personal stories." Tears stung my eyes. My ears started ringing. Once again, Oprah's words reached into my very soul, and this time I was ready. With the help of my daughter, Rachel, I penned my 2019 memoir, An Impossible Life, the inspiring true story of a woman's struggle from within. It won the Eric Hoffer Grand Prize in 2022. The mental health secrets I had buried like cursed treasure were now out on display for the entire world to read. The binge eating that had me tipping the scales at 250 pounds, racking up $150,000 in credit card debt due to a manic episode, countless ER visits, psychiatric hospital stays, my broken marriage, and my suicide attempt. My illness had not changed one bit from 30 years ago when I was first diagnosed. All that's changed is my capacity to manage it, as well as the strength I have received through speaking my truth. I am no longer a victim, but a victor. I am no longer silent, but have joined a growing choir for mental health advocacy. I used to ask God, why me? Now I ask, why, God, have you entrusted me with this challenge of mental illness? I am in awe that he trusts me and believes in me to take on that task and be successful. As Oprah appeared on Zoom, I squeezed my daughter's hand. Many of the brave inmates stood and shared their heartbreaking and trauma-filled stories. While listening to them, I thought about all the times I have sat and cried with them as they shared their childhood experiences and all the ways those experiences affected their mental health. I've watched these women sit outside on the cement surrounded by barbed wire and watchtowers with my daughter singing, "Light in the darkness, my God, that is who you are." An inmate who played the guitar has been featured on Forensic Files in 48 hours. Many are murderers, and there is no excusing their acts of violence, but I still love them, and their mental health is important too. Oprah's healing words that day gave them hope they could have a meaningful future. The fact is, mental health challenges do not discriminate and can happen to anyone. It doesn't matter one's race, religion, gender, age, sexual orientation, or economic background. Each voice is important, even women in prisons. Our next article by Stephanie Farrington is titled, "Stop the Misery Go Round of Constant Worrying." My brain is often in a state of excess rumination, loops of thoughts that plague me with doubt, worry, anxiety, or sadness, and send volts of unease through my body on a regular basis. National and international news events, along with the pandemic, have only exacerbated my agitation, as has been the case for many of us. I often turn to my spouse, Sabrina, and a close cadre of girlfriends to tease out my tangled cogitations. Recently, however, when my head couldn't land on a solution to a difficult problem, my close friend Grace listened to me emote and overthink for nearly an hour with godly levels of patience when she finally said, "My answer to your problem is to purchase Ethan Cross's Chatter, The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters, and How to Harness It." Then she refused to get off the phone until my purchase was complete. Juggling multiple projects and family responsibilities, including sweet ones like my 6-year-old daughter Marty, leaves little time for pleasure reading or contemplating self-help guides, but Grace was right. I was in mental free fall, and only I could catch or save myself. When Cross's slim volume arrived in the mail, I was hooked from page one. Cross, a psychology professor at the University of Michigan who studies emotion and self-control, lays out an easy-to-implement set of tools to stop the endless rotation of what I've come to call my misery go-round. I was relieved to learn that when I became irrationally stressed, scared, or worried, I'm in a zone of destructive thinking, and there are steps I can take to disrupt the chain of unsettling thoughts and redirect my thinking. On a sunny day in New York City earlier this spring, I had the privilege of Zooming with Cross, fresh off a plane from a family sojourn in Hawaii, to hear more about the 5 science-backed tools he identifies in his book that can disrupt and end our self-punishing circles of thought. Dig into his advice below and see how the methods, which I've already started practicing, are working out for me. Tap into the awesomeness of it all. One way to turn down the volume on our self-focused and self-harming chatter is to seek out and contemplate awe. You can muse on the breathtaking enormity of the cosmos or anything that moves that sense of wonder in you, says Cross. Air and space travel fill him with the sense that this is much bigger than anything I can do or have done, he says. The effect of that is that it shrinks the self and puts our worries in perspective, he explains. I was just on an airplane with my kids yesterday. We're at 30,000 feet, and I look over to my daughter, Maya, and say, "Just think. It wasn't that long ago when we were struggling to build fires. We went from that to learning how to fly and to do it safely." For me, when I consider the vastness and beauty of the sky at sunrise and sunset, or the sound of the wind through the trees, or the glow of the moon on a clear night, the same moon seen by fellow humans in lands unknown to me, I too am able to quiet the rattle in my head. Walk into nature. Similar to awe, the marvelous immensity of the natural environment can play an important role in giving perspective to our problems and calming our minds. In fact, countless studies demonstrate nature's ability to heal and improve our mental health. Cross, who points out the lush green plants in his immaculate office, says that research shows that even watching videos of nature for as little as a few minutes has redemptive qualities. While the more immersive our experience is, the more beneficial it is, Cross encourages us to seek out nature in whatever dose and format we can, including asking Alexa to fire up some tunes from the great outdoors, waterfalls, birds, waves. There's a paper that shows that listening to sounds from the natural world captures our attention in a very gentle, soft way, similar to how visual images of nature do, he says. Cross's sometimes collaborator, Aslam Aiduk, PhD, a distinguished professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, weighing in from Turkey via Zoom, wonders whether the color green may also offer mental noise-canceling properties for the ways we identify it with nature, although she's quick to add, research does not yet demonstrate this. Still, to help inspire and evoke thoughts of nature, I decided to buy a thin leather green bracelet from Ka Sales on Etsy to remind myself that I just have to be, and nothing more when the wheels start spinning me inside out. It helps steady and settle my mind. Talk to yourself in the second or third person. Cross's research shows that one way to create distance between yourself and a problem you can't stop brooding on is to identify your first-person narrator and challenge it with constructive thoughts. For example, instead of saying, "I have to resolve this growing problem between me and my colleague," you might say, "Stephanie, you can and will resolve this issue between you and your colleague in due time." When Cross's chatter starts, he says he has a whole ritual for calming it down that starts with distant self-talk. I try to coach myself using my own name. Trying to think through the problem that way helps me be level-headed and objective, he says. The space it creates also takes some of the charge or emotion out of it to help give you mental clarity on the issue. When I do it, I visualize myself on my misery go-round, a darker version of the merry-go-round, and say, "Stephanie, ask the attendant to let you off the ride and leave your unhelpful worries on the carousel." I make my request and the ride slows down, then stops. I leave my troubles on it. Then I walk onto the nearby boardwalk to watch the ocean waves at sunset on a breezy, balmy night, conjuring nature to calm and restore myself. It's surprisingly effective at relaxing my heightened emotional states and creating a sense of serenity. Create temporal distance. Considering how the issue troubling your mind will matter or not in the near or far future also helps give you perspective. How am I going to feel about this next week or a month from now or a year from now, Cross says. If you find that the problem that plagues you doesn't have tentacles that reach out beyond this fraught moment, it tempers your angst. It makes you realize that this is going to be just one little part of your life, Aiduk adds. It's really temporary. It's not going to be here forever. It basically shrinks its importance. I take Cross and Aiduk's advice one anxious day and imagine myself in 20 years, 66 years old, retired on the Cape with my spouse Sabrina, where this worry has no place, and feel better. Start a ritual to quiet chatter. Similar to athletic teams that often perform idiosyncratic rituals to steady their minds and nerves before games, Cross says we can develop our own rituals. When he prepares for an important presentation to quell his inner voice, he does the following. 1, he advises himself in the third person using his own name. 2, he exercises some temporal distancing to put things in perspective. And 3, he pounds his fist into the palm of his hand a few times. The key is developing one and implementing it. What you do in the actual ritual doesn't really matter. It's the fact that you're doing it in a very rigid sequence or order, he explains. Heeding Cross's suggestion, once my perseverating starts, I now rely on a two-step ritual. First, I take deep, diaphragmatic breaths, and it leads me back to a steadier feeling. Then I imagine myself on my merry-go-round, talking myself down in the third person, and I instantly feel calmer. My friend Grace poignantly points out that Cross's model for slowing and quieting ruminative thoughts recalls children's behaviors in early youth, when we floated on clouds of wonder, enchanted with nature, even dirt, and talked ourselves through difficult challenges like tying our shoes or stacking blocks, and naturally relied on little rituals for comfort, bedtime and morning routines. I think it's a very astute observation, Cross says, and an interesting idea. It is the case that many of these tools are ones that we first learn when we're young. For example, we learn how to control ourselves by giving ourselves instructions and repeating the things that our caretakers say to us. In an academic context, I often describe distant self-talk as a very primitive tool, something foundational to how we learn to self-control, but then we forget about it, he explains. Luckily, I have a pint-sized family member to remind me of Cross's strategies for stopping my dizzying mental carousel. My 6-year-old daughter, Marty, who has taught me the most about what it means to love and be human, often marvels at the moon, loves rolling down grassy hills in our park, and ritualistically wakes each morning yelling, "Good morning, everybody!" She's the gift that brings Cross's tips to life, helping me escape overthinking and stay present for this moment. Our next article by Asia Gable is titled, "The Secret Loneliness of Miscarriage." The first time I was pregnant, I didn't understand that it was supposed to be a secret, and therefore that I too was a secret. After some months of trying, I found out I was pregnant in early March, and I celebrated with my husband in all the ways you're supposed to. We took pictures of the test sticks, cried, fought about eating raw cookie dough, made a list of absurd baby names, and stared at my stomach, willing it to grow. I called a few close friends and told them 6 weeks and was met with hushed tones. "So early," they said. I told them I wasn't one of those women who was going to keep it a secret from them because if something bad happened, something bad, I always said, I would tell them that part anyway. Isn't it better to have someone with you on the journey than to suffer the bad news alone? An app gave me size comparisons, and they were as silly as everyone said they'd be. Your baby is the size of a pea. Your baby is the size of a pumpkin seed. What the app didn't say, your baby is so small, if you held it, it could slip through your fingers. It didn't say, if you lose a pumpkin seed, don't tell anyone. When my dad died of stomach cancer at the age of 62, my mother warned me not to tell anyone. She said it would look bad, him dying at that age instead of in his 70s or 80s, as if we had done something wrong or didn't try hard enough. But when you're 21 and a senior in college, no one asks why your parent died or how or what it looked like. So I stored those details in my head and walked around campus with them, marching toward my future. Only once did they come tumbling out during my first ever panic attack on a street corner before midterms. Everyone thought I was freaked out about my Ulysses exam. The summer before my dad died, I moved home and spent syrupy warm California afternoons with him. My dad had been a carpenter on construction sites all his life, and I'd never known him not to be doing physical labor. That summer, though, we lazed. We sat on the couch and watched the Ellen DeGeneres show. Sometimes we saw cheap Tuesday matinees. Sometimes I made him smoothies, which he drank only half of while we read books side by side. Sometimes I drove him to chemo, where we cheerfully talked of anything other than the slow poison coursing through his veins. But those late afternoons on the couch, sometimes I would lie down while he sat, resting my head on his chest and stomach. He had a big Santa Claus belly, though in his post-cancer life it shrank. We watched Ellen dance in the audience, and I listened to the steady beat of his heart. You might think I did this to comfort myself, to hear evidence of his aliveness. But it only scared me. There, beneath my ear, was the sound of the fragile mechanism keeping my dad alive, a muscle that at any moment could decide it's had enough. I heard the hush of blood, the creaking of veins adjusting to the work of living. There it is, I thought. Not evidence that he was alive, but evidence that what was keeping him alive was awfully tender, a mere viscous wish beneath his bones. I miscarried on a Saturday in April. I'd just eaten pancakes. I rushed from the kitchen to the bathroom and felt, unmistakably, a piece of me that was supposed to be lodged inside my uterus fall with a gentle plop. I stayed in the bathroom a while, alone, staring at it, memorizing it, before rejoining my husband at the kitchen table and telling him calmly, "It happened. I think it's over." I was calm then because the days leading up to it had been the opposite of calm. The cramps were the worst I'd ever felt, flattening me onto the bed, springing tears to my eyes before I could muster up the accompanying sadness, my body knowing before my mind that something was wrong inside. My husband would crouch by the bed and hold my hand, watching my eyes to measure the pain. He did everything he could, but this particular pain wasn't communal. It was deeply private to have my body's shutters teach me about the loss. I couldn't explain it to him while it was happening. I couldn't even explain it to myself. That, too, was part of the grief. When I was lying there, I thought of the concept of suffering, a childhood fixation of mine. I grew up in the Jodo Shinshu sect of the Japanese Buddhist church. Although my mom is Japanese and my dad was white, my dad was the one who dragged us to temple every weekend. And every weekend I learned what suffering meant. According to the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, we suffer because we're attached to things. I squirmed in my pew and thought of the cartoons I was missing, the pickled daikon I'd be forced to choke down at church lunch after this. I wanted waffles and MTV. I wanted sleeping in and bike riding until dinner. I wanted the things I was attached to. But I sat there and suffered the suffering. Decades later, I thought of that temple and the teachings as I grasped for anything to get me through this miscarriage cramping. What am I resisting letting go? What could I learn from knowing this suffering is not strange but deeply normal? When the cramps would subside, I would quiet and try to listen, but I heard nothing. Years after my dad died, I wondered if he too thought of those teachings when he was in his final days. One of those days, he was allowed to walk down the hall in his hospital gown and look out the big window at the end where the sun was setting. I remember him sitting on a chair staring out that window, wearing an expression that I'd never seen before. Anguish. I was upset then because he wasn't looking at me standing next to him and he wasn't mourning all that he would miss in my life. But now I know he was taking in the world, knowing he wouldn't have it much longer, letting each piece of it go, including me. A few days later, he told the doctors he wanted to have a final meal. By then, his body had stopped processing food, the tumors on his stomach having spread everywhere, so they sedated him and medically emptied his stomach, preparing him to eat with us one last time. Even now, thinking about this again, I can't tell you what it was like. I can't even tell the other people in the room what it was like. And when it happens to you, you won't be able to tell me. And whoever you're with, as they die, they won't be able to tell you. And we will all suffer carrying universal knowledge we can never share. Miscarriages are incredibly common, and that's part of what made the mourning process painful. How can so many people go through this and so few communicate what it's really like? Are there really legions of women walking around, holding their bodies, wrenching inside of them? Of course there are. It's the loneliness of having a woman's body, and the loneliness of having a body. Even more common than having a miscarriage is becoming pregnant, which I did for a second time 2 months later. This time, I held the secret even closer, which made me feel small as my body grew. Each day, I was afraid that the fetus would just slip away, maybe without me even knowing. I watched for signs. I felt terrified at the slightest twitch of pain, and I felt terrified if I felt nothing. My husband told me not to worry, that worrying wouldn't make the baby stay or go. That wasn't how it worked. But he didn't know what it was to be a host of something invisible. Because I began to worry him with my worry, I kept it to myself more, as I kept the pregnancy in general from my friends and family. It felt lonely there, swirling in that concern, but I learned that it also felt lonely to share it. When I told people about the miscarriage, there were so many wonderful notes from friends expressing sympathy and love, or confessing that they too had gone through it. But even in the notes from the people who'd gone through it and worse, there was no salve or cure. Instead, it was as if the two of us stood in adjacent cells and stared at each other, wondering how to get out. It was nice to have company, but it didn't change the fact that I was locked up. As I write this, I have yet to tell everyone in my life I'm pregnant. I'm far enough along that I should tell people. I could tell people. But I felt uneasy about the pregnancy, always worried, confused about what is happening in my body, unsure if I am supposed to celebrate or wait to celebrate. Until the baby passes a certain ultrasound scan, until the baby is here, until it's out of the infant stage, until it's walking, until it's talking. But then there's more worry to come. School and friends and happiness. Not to mention political disaster, civic disaster, climate disaster. And it's not just worry about the baby's life that keeps me swallowing the news of my pregnancy. It's worry about myself, too. Am I doing it right now? And will I do it right later? I'm upset I can't eat what I want, go where I want, and wear what I want. Sometimes I break into sobs at episodes of The West Wing or The Great British Baking Show. Sometimes I look at my body and feel sad I might never again look like I used to look. There's so much to do wrong, and yet I continue to swell. The thing no one told me about pregnancy is that when you are pregnant, you carry a secret, and so you are a secret to yourself. You are also a secret to your partner. You carry this alone. You cannot truly share the pain of growing life, just as you cannot truly share the pain of letting life go. For hours after doctors declared my father formally deceased, my family and I stayed in the hospice room with him, with his body. We didn't discuss leaving, but we also didn't discuss staying. The staff came and went, asking us if we needed anything, but they never told us what to do, one way or another. My mother called the reverend of our temple, and we waited. I remember sitting on the corner of the bed his body lay on and thinking, this is just his body. He is no longer here. I no longer feel him here. I never believed in spirits or souls before that, and I'm not sure I believe in them now in exactly the way some people do. But that day I gathered together not a belief but an assurance that a person and a body are separate things, distinct clusters of energy that do what they want, sometimes in opposing directions. That's what cancer was inside my dad, growing and regrowing and jumping from organ to organ despite everything he did to stop it. And that's what my dad was, despite the cancer. A man who enjoyed cooking, liked to look at the stars and planets, and cared for the family's small dog in the lonely days of his final years. Each a distinct entity, the person and the body. The reason I know this is because as the feeling of my father receded with the terrible knowledge that he would never open his eyes again, his body swelled. When the reverend showed up after we'd been sitting there for hours, I saw her see it too. He was huge. He was a decomposing body. He was not my father anymore. Yet as his body expanded, I thought of those afternoons I spent with him the summer before, lying with my head on his chest, trying to get as close to his thumping heart as possible, even though it scared me. I knew that I had been right. Our bodies are our most kept secrets. Round ligament pain is a sharp jabbing pain during pregnancy that happens in your lower abdomen as your uterus grows and stretches to accommodate the baby. Some nights I'm awoken by it, a feeling I at first confused for having to pee, then confused for a contraction. Then I settle into the understanding that it's the wrenching of my body expanding. Sometimes I joke about poking my husband's stomach with something sharp so he'll understand what it feels like, but even then I know he wouldn't really know. The pain has to come from inside. Last night, as I was roused by the sharp jabbing, I thought about this. I looked at my husband, sleeping soundly next to me. I know there's more expansion and more pain to come later in the pregnancy and labor, the sort I can't even imagine right now. And I won't really be able to share the suffering with him, no matter how hard I squeeze his hand or scream or bleed. My husband's father is also gone. He died a couple of months before our first date. On that date, I asked him about it. He was taken aback at first and told me people don't usually bring it up. I told him that when my dad died, people also didn't ask me about it, for fear of upsetting me, but I was upset anyway, all day, every day. And when people didn't even try to ask, I felt even more alone in that pain. So I make a point to ask people how they're doing if they've newly lost someone. Recently, my husband told me that moment on our first date was part of what made him fall in love with me, that I opened myself so clearly to him right away, to a part of him that might be painful and ugly. I was surprised when he said that, knowing that I could never carry his grief the way he can never carry mine. But I came to understand that it didn't matter. It only mattered that I'd asked, that I'd offered to stand in the same prison with him, at least for a little while. The company was nice because the loneliness of grief was a hard burden to bear. In bed next to my husband, I tried to remember if the reverend had said any wise words when she came to the hospice where my father lay. In my memory, she said nothing, only laid her hand on his shoulder and remained there with us. Maybe she did that because there was nothing to say. Yes, life is suffering, and suffering is attachment, and we are attached to our fathers and mothers and partners and children, and also our pets who can't speak, and the planets we've never been to, and sometimes unborn fetuses. And eventually, all of us have to loosen the grip of our attachment and let go. Everyone is a secret made of mysterious enzymes and hormones, anger and desires. I don't know this baby expanding my body, though I am literally attached to it, one secret body making another. What matters is that we try to cross the distance from me to you, from my strange body to yours, from my loneliness to yours. The pain in my abdomen, it's the crossing. The Body Secret by Asia Gable, excerpted from The Lonely Stories, an anthology edited by Natalie Eve Garrett. Our next article by Carrie Bell is titled, How Chef Chris Williams Has Brought His Community Together One Meal at a Time. Chef Christopher Williams has been a part of the service industry since his first job slinging baby back ribs and margs of the month at a Texas chain restaurant at 17. But it wasn't until a global pandemic darkened the world's doorstep more than 2 decades later that he truly learned what it meant to be of service instead of just in it. By the time COVID-19 started spreading in 2020, Williams had come a long way since his days as a free refill waiter. After learning knife skills and kitchen lingo at culinary school in Austin in 2003, he jumped around restaurant gigs in his hometown of Houston and in D.C., including runs with eateries helmed by TV competition show winner, an excellent little Thai place, a wine bar, a Canadian hostel, and a West Indian Jamaican eatery, where he picked up little things to add to his culinary toolkit. He also spent 3 years traveling around the UK and Europe, grabbing any hospitality job, bartender, manager, dishwasher, line cook, he could get, after following a girl to London didn't pan out. Eventually returning to D.C., he talked his way into the executive chef position at a famed hotel. I had no business being in charge of an entire F&B program, as I had no culinary perspective, never even written a menu. But I interviewed really well back then, Williams, now 43, tells Oprah Daily with a laugh. It wasn't the only time a fake-it-till-you-make-it strategy would serve him well. Flash forward to 2012, when Williams, while heading to the Children's Museum with his two young sons, stumbled upon a 1923 mission-style home for lease in Houston's Museum District. Something deep down in his gut told him it was the perfect place to build out his dream, despite never having owned his own eatery. Sometimes you just know. It was unlocked, so me and my ducks walked in, and I immediately started to see what Lucille's is now, the 2022 James Beard Award nominee for National Outstanding Restaurateur recalls, referring to his now critically lauded restaurant. Had no clue how we were going to do it, but sometimes you have to say, screw it, let's do it. Williams took his cherished family recipes and every penny he and his co-owner and brother Ben Williams could scrape together to open Lucille's. Serving what he calls well-refined Southern cuisine defined by history, Lucille's is named after and inspired by his great-grandmother, Lucille B. Smith. As the first woman to run her own business in the Lone Star State, a cookbook author, inventor of America's first instant hot roll mix, and the creator of one of the first college-level commercial food and technology programs in Texas, she was a gastronomic trailblazer. Smith was also active in her church and community, always utilizing her culinary craft to fundraise and caretake, and opening her door to visiting VIPs and civil rights leaders like Joe Louis and Martin Luther King Jr., unwelcome at area hotels or restaurants. Essentially, she gave me the blueprint. She started her business from the exact same place that I started mine, using her mastery of one thing to improve things for her family and better serve her community, he says. I learned very early on in all those jobs I mentioned that nothing happens in a restaurant without community, both the one that comes in and pays the bills and the one you have to create to put the kind of food on the table that keeps the first one coming back. Kitchens are so dynamic in terms of education levels, world perspectives, and personality types. There are 7 different languages in my kitchen. Without that community, there's nothing because I can't do this on my own, especially not now. I've forgotten too many things. That's why when the pandemic hit, it was the first community he vowed to take care of. Our sales were down 92%, but I had to keep my commitment to my work family. Nobody was going to get furloughed here. Everybody could stay on who wanted to, who felt safe. With that, I had all the staff, but no business. That's when he decided to help the larger community around him. We saw the needs of first responders, specifically those on the graveyard shift, and being people of action, we started cooking for them, says Williams, whose team pumped out 3,000 meals in roughly 20 days. It felt good to be helpful in times that felt so helpless. The impressive good deed did not go unnoticed. Benefactors with deep pockets not only helped keep the meal delivery afloat, but motivated Williams to widen its reach and establish a nonprofit, Lucille's 1913. When word spread around Space City that Williams was funneling Lucille's profits back into the program, he started to see an uptick in diners eager to eat for a good cause, which in turn meant 1913 could implement even more initiatives. The group expanded the meal distribution to include the elderly in several assisted living facilities and underserved areas like Acre Homes, Third Ward, Fifth Ward, and Sunnyside, where most of Williams' father's family is from. You know parts of town that are historically black, historically poor food deserts with no grocery stores, Williams says. The elderly were uniquely affected by this and were cut off from their families. It struck a chord because they're the ones who already changed the world, the ones that led the civil rights movement. They deserve better than what the existing meal programs were doing. I wanted to create meals with dignity that considered people's palates and their historic health issues like diabetes. We cater the menus to each community or group we are serving, be it Black, Hispanic, or Afghani refugees. The nonprofit swung into action when Texas was hit by a power grid crippling winter storm in February 2021. They took food to shelters and a warming center set up in a furniture store. They added the school next door to one of 1913's kitchens to their daily distribution list and to date have issued more than 510,000 meals. They also held a voter registration drive and let other struggling bars pop up in Lucille's massive patio when only outdoor dining was allowed in Houston. But it's the launch of several urban farms that really has Williams enthused. To have real, sustainable, impactful change, we have to do more than feed elders and babies. That's why we've evolved into the farming component. The farms employ people from the communities we serve at a living wage, teach them skills to keep feeding themselves and their neighbors, and bring dignity back to this trade. It ensures that there is affordable, fresh food they're familiar with, like okra, collard greens, and sweet potatoes in these food deserts. It reduces shame because moms can afford to feed their kids nutritious stuff. Jobs bring ownership and comfort, and those make people take pride in their neighborhood. They're working alongside their neighbors or selling to them, and that increases community. I'm not really a big thinker. I don't spend a lot of time contemplating the future, but even I can see the positive side effects spiraling in all directions. It's only recently that Williams has allowed himself to reflect on what he and 1913 have accomplished in the past couple of years, and to accept that his restaurant's namesake would be proud. Of course, it's so much easier to pick up somebody else's torch than to start your own fire. Lucille gave us the blueprint. It's only natural for us to follow her example when our business is so connected to the familial story, Williams says. It feels good to think we have carried on what she started, that she'd approve of the difference we're trying to make. I also think she'd ask what we're doing next. Our next article by Genesis Rivas is titled, A Comprehensive and Easy Guide to Building a Skincare Routine. The best skincare advice we can offer? Establish a thoughtful, personalized skincare routine and stick with it. Consistency is key, as is patience. It takes time, typically 4 weeks, for skincare formulas to begin to show results, says Morgan Robick, MD, a board-certified dermatologist based in New York City. Following a routine sounds easy enough, but for many, it's surprisingly difficult. The skincare world, a nearly $100 billion industry, is churning out more new product options than ever, and each one promises to work miracles. The most common challenge my patients face is navigating the sheer volume of choices, marketing, and messaging, says Iram Ilias, MD, a board-certified dermatologist at Schweiger Dermatology Group. This can cause not only impulse purchasing and information overload, but also skin issues, since using too many different products can lead to dryness and irritation. Bottom line, ignore the noise and focus on the right routine for you. To do that, identify your current skin struggles, dryness, dark spots, acne, fine lines, and your skin goals, glowier skin, more firmness. These keywords will help guide you to the products you need, says Adam Tinklepaw, MD, a board-certified dermatologist at MDCS Dermatology. We break down more on what to look for and the correct order to apply them below. How to build a skincare routine. Your routine should have three goals: cleansing, treating, and protecting the skin, says Azeda Shirazi, MD, a board-certified dermatologist. Learn how to pick the products for each step ahead. Step 1, cleanser. Look for a gentle formula instead of one with lots of active ingredients, Ilias says. The goal of cleansing is to reduce oil buildup from the night before or impurities that accumulated throughout the day. Some people like to have a cleanser that exfoliates or treats issues, but ingredients need to be on your skin for at least 1 minute to have any impact, says Shirazi. Simply putting it on and rinsing it off doesn't do much. If you have oily skin, opt for a foaming or gel formula, which will give you a deeper clean. If you have dry or sensitive skin, try a cream cleanser. If you wear makeup, you may want to do a double cleanse in the evening. First, you'll apply an oil-based cleansing balm, which breaks down makeup, and then your foam, gel, or cream cleanser, explains Rybak. No matter your skin type, don't cleanse more than twice a day, which can strip your skin's natural oils. Oil on our skin is healthy and normal. It keeps us from drying out, Tinklepaw says. Step 2, treatment. Now that your skin is clean, you want to apply a formula that targets your specific skin concern. It should contain an active ingredient such as vitamin C, alpha and beta hydroxy acids, niacinamide, or retinol, Shirazi says. Ingredients like these are proven to address dullness, dryness, uneven texture, pimples, fine lines, dark spots, or loss of firmness. To brighten skin, look for kojic acid, vitamin C, or niacinamide. To hydrate, look for ceramides, squalane, glycerin, hyaluronic acid, panthenol, provitamin B5, shea butter, or oat complexes. To soften fine lines or wrinkles or help firm skin, use a retinol alternative like bakuchiol or glycolic acid. To treat acne, try salicylic acid, benzoyl peroxide, or retinol. Look for a toner, an essence, or a serum. These are lightweight and meant to sink into your skin. Applying actives onto just clean skin increases their effectiveness, Ilias says. A word of caution. Many people try to apply multiple treatments, but this can overwhelm the skin, says Shirazi. It's always best to stick to one active treatment product for at least 4 weeks before adding a second, and don't combine multiple exfoliants like glycolic acid and a retinol, for example. You'll damage the skin barrier. Number 3, protection. Moisturizing your skin is the third critical step. In the morning, make sure your moisturizer contains SPF to protect you from UV and blue light, says Ilias. For the evening, use a moisturizer with top-notch hydrators that repair skin overnight. If your skin is on the oily side, go for a lightweight moisturizer that contains hyaluronic acid, Ilias recommends. For anti-aging, I favor a moisturizer that contains stem cells, niacinamide, resveratrol, or caffeine to help support cell renewal, says Shirazi. Our next article by Leslie Goldman is titled, For Women of Color, Menopause is Different. As the creator of Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause podcast and social media project, Omasati Bernice Scott, 55, has two missions. The first is to normalize menopause, a natural event that will happen to more than half of the population yet still remains shrouded in silence. The second, to center the voices of Black women and gender-expansive individuals who experience many of the same symptoms that white women do, hot flashes, insomnia, joint pain, but often do so in a very different and usually more intense way. Hers is an enormous undertaking, with 50 million plus U.S. women, women-identifying people, and non-binary people currently in menopause, defined as the end of one's menstrual cycles, and millions more in perimenopause, the 4 to 10 years leading up to it. More than a third of these are women of color, yet this universal hormonal phenomenon is rarely discussed within their communities, and the experiences and stories of Black and Latinx women are rarely centered in the media or by physicians. According to Denise Pines, immediate past president of the Medical Board of California and founder of Wise Pause Wellness, a pro-aging platform. When we read about menopause, we think of white women's menopause experiences because those are the stories that get told, Pines says. But while our biology may be the same, our experiences are not. Black and Latinx women enter menopause earlier and have longer-lasting, more intense symptoms. Hispanic women are more likely to report feeling bothered by vaginal dryness, urine leakage, and increased heart rate, whereas Black women frequently cite hot flashes and night sweats, according to the Study of Women's Health Across the Nation, or SWAN, a decades-long study examining the health of midlife women across ethnicities. Bernie Scott notes that news reports will often briefly mention the fact that Black and Latinx women have longer and more intense symptoms of menopause, but then there is a hard stop. What about the why? Earlier menopause, worse symptoms. The average age of menopause in the U.S. is 51. SWAN findings reveal that Black women tend to begin menopause about 9 months earlier than white women. Other SWAN findings show that Black and Hispanic women endure hot flashes for several years longer than other racial and ethnic groups, 10 years and 9 years respectively, versus 6.5 for non-Hispanic white women, and Black women experience irregular bleeding for longer periods of time than white women. Michelle A. Albert, MD, MPH, professor of medicine at the University of California at San Francisco, president-elect of the American Heart Association, and president of the Association of Black Cardiologists, says this phenomenon, called early-onset menopause, triggers a cascade of events leading to worsened health outcomes for BIPOC women. Cardioprotective estrogen plummets during menopause, meaning all women, regardless of race or ethnicity, experience an increase in heart disease and stroke risk during and after the menopausal transition, but the earlier the age of menopause, the greater the risk. Female hormones also help to protect you from obesity and insomnia, as well as keep cholesterol levels down, and those are all factors associated with elevated heart disease risk too, Albert says. Additionally, early onset menopause ups the risks of osteoporosis, estrogen helps keep bones strong, and depression. Black women are also 3 times more likely to experience premature menopause, menopause before age 40, sometimes caused by smoking or autoimmune conditions such as lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, compared with white women, leading to a 40% higher risk of developing coronary heart disease over their lifetime, per research presented at a 2021 American Heart Association, or AHA, meeting. When racism, stress, and menopause meet. A 2022 SWAN study published in Women's Midlife Health proposes that some of the disparities that exist between white women and women of color in perimenopause and menopause are likely attributable to structural racism in the U.S. This link is yet to be definitively proven, notes study co-author and SWAN investigator Tanae T. Lewis, Ph.D., associate professor of epidemiology at Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health in Atlanta. But we know that stress matters, explains Albert. It's called allostatic load, which refers to the wear and tear from lifetime and ongoing stressors that Black women disproportionately face compared with white women. Systemic racism, including poor access to health care, toxic work environments, unsafe neighborhoods, socioeconomic challenges, and more, can weather the body, overtaxing various hormonal and biological processes and fueling chronic inflammation. This can lead to long-lasting health ramifications, including an earlier, more challenging menopause. Misconceptions lead to worse care. Despite the fact that Black women enter menopause earlier and the symptoms last longer, they are the least likely to leave the office with a prescription for hormone treatment, says Sharon Malone, MD, Washington, D.C.-based OBGYN and chief medical officer of Alloy Women's Health. This may have to do with the common but erroneous belief that Black people have a higher pain tolerance, suggest some experts. Women of color often go to the doctor and the doctor says, "Oh, no, you're too young for menopause," Pine says. Or they want you to grind it out and women walk away with nothing. Or they assume patients can't afford hormone replacement therapy or other solutions. This goes beyond a comfort issue. Symptoms like hot flashes and weight gain can be linked to future heart disease, diabetes, and other serious conditions that are already more prevalent among Black and Latinx women. Ways to advocate for yourself. Several of the experts interviewed for this story said there are concrete steps BIPOC women can take to help flip the script and improve the odds of an easier, healthier menopausal transition. Do what you can to mitigate stress. Higher levels of physical activity help to lower the effects of stress. Aim for 30 to 45 minutes a day of moving your body in a way that gets your heart pumping, suggests Albert. Get some friends together and form a track walking group at your local gym or YMCA. Exercise may also help prevent heart disease, ease hot flashes, boost mood, and support healthy weight management. Important because Black and Latinx women tend to have higher rates of obesity than white women, which intensifies hot flashes and night sweats. Stress can also be lessened by looking toward the thing that gives you a higher sense of purpose, Albert says. For many people of color, scripture can be an important means to achieve a sense of peace. Mindfulness works too. Try the Exhale app, an emotional well-being app created by entrepreneur, pastor, and life coach Katara McCarty for Black, Indigenous, and women of color, BIWOC, or take an online yoga class with sexuality educator, menopause mentor, and yoga instructor Gabriela Espinoza. If you smoke, try to quit. The Black Women's Health Imperative notes that Black women who smoke often do so to cope with stress. Smoking is strongly linked with an earlier age of menopause, not to mention heart disease, cancer, stroke, and diabetes, the four leading causes of death among African Americans, per the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Find a doctor who sees you. The number of Black and Latinx physicians in the U.S. is dismal, Pine says, so it's not an option to just find a doctor of color. Also disheartening, in a 2019 Mayo Clinic Proceedings study, only 7% of medical residents expressed confidence in their ability to counsel patients about menopause. Bernie Scott says word of mouth among close friends is an ideal way to find a trusted, knowledgeable provider. Or use the North American Menopause Society, or NAMS, website, Find a Menopause Practitioner feature, to locate a nearby provider who practices menopause management, or Black Doctor 24/7. NAMS also provides some educational materials in Spanish, including articles on hot flashes, vaginal dryness, memory problems, and hormone therapy. Reframe how you view menopause. A negative outlook on menopause tends to be associated with more frequent and severe symptoms. Yamnia I. Cortez, Ph.D., M.D., an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Nursing, who studies Latinas, perimenopause, and heart disease, says la menopausia or el cambio de vida can be viewed negatively among Latinas, with many women feeling a sense of loss that they can't have babies anymore or that they cannot control their bodies. Pines adds that the stigma surrounding vaginal dryness and incontinence compounds the problem. In Black communities, though, both Pines and Bernie Scott report an overarching hallelujah mentality, as Black women disproportionately suffer so much with PMS, heavy blood flow, and painful fibroids, that the notion it will come to an end is welcome. Of course, experiences and views vary, which is why both feel a more open dialogue and a centering of BIPOC stories is even more imperative. Malone notes there are plenty of positives accompanying this time of life in general. For a lot of women, it's the first time they get to focus on themselves. You've been concerned about your children, your job, the lens through which people view you, and trying to live up to those expectations. You get to 55, and it's freeing. Our next article is Oprah wants you to reconnect with the fun in life. After a conversation with a friend, Oprah was inspired to think about where she finds her fun. Hey, Oprah Insiders. I want to ask y'all a question. A friend of mine actually asked me this question. The friend, who is over 40, sent me a text saying that he was in his garage working on his model airplanes. He likes to build model airplanes and fly them. For years he was doing that, and that was fun. In the text he was saying, "But now I'm wondering, is this still fun, or is this something I'm just doing?" I want to ask you, what is fun for you? I said, "You know, that's a really interesting question." Gail has fun all the time. We can go to an event and we'll leave and she'll say, "Wow, that was so much fun." And I'm like, "Were we at the same thing? You and I have a very different definition of what fun is." Then the other morning I was sitting with Stedman. We were having breakfast overlooking the ocean with some delicious French toast and orange juice. He was like, "Wow, this is so much fun." I'm like, is it fun or is it just pleasurable? To the friend that posed this question, I said, "You know, I think that's a good question, and I'm going to ask the insiders. Particularly for those of you over 40, or even over 50, or older than that. If you're younger, I want to know what's fun for you too." I'm still trying to figure it out for myself. I used to be walking with my dogs in the woods, but now there's so many coyotes around here that that's no longer fun. Yesterday, I was cocooning under this really lovely blanket a friend had sent to me. I was reading a book, and I built a fire, and it was a wonderful, warm, delicious feeling. But was it fun? I don't know. This article is a part of a series where Oprah is setting an intention exclusively for Oprah Daily Insiders, with reflections on topics like letting go, forgiveness, coming to your own, and more. Yesterday, I was cocooning under this really lovely blanket a friend had sent to me. I was reading a book and I built a fire and it was a wonderful, warm, delicious feeling. But was it fun? I don't know. This article is a part of a series where Oprah is setting an intention exclusively for Oprah Daily Insiders, with reflections on topics like letting go, forgiveness, coming to your own, and more. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.